a fractional CMO can be incredibly effective and can get you where you want to go far faster than going through an entire hiring process and losing money on, this is probably the hot take, the VP you might fire in 9 months anyway.
I'm Jonathan Gandolf, and welcome to the Content Cocktail Hour, powered by The Juice. Our mission is to squeeze out the deepest secrets of B2B marketing professionals to help you push your brand to the forefront of the industry. Let's raise the glass. Welcome back to the Content Cocktail Hour. It is Jonathan Gandolf here, founder and CEO of The Juice, with a fresh episode. And I am thrilled to be joined by Shannon Curran, founder and fractional CMO. We're going to dig into what that day-to-day looks like, kind of the big bet that she took on herself, which I'm excited to hear more about. But before we do all of that, Shannon, I'd love for you to introduce yourself, share a little bit about your background and what you're up to, and then we'll dig into the conversation.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it. So my name is Shannon. We're joking that my title is the hardest question you're going to ask me today. So I'm technically the founder of SSC Consulting, but I really am a fractional CMO and marketing executive coach consultant working with early stage companies all in the B2B software world, specifically working with folks that really want to use their founder story to help drive growth in their company. So I spent the last 8-ish years in B2B tech, from, you know, private equity owned companies all the way down to early stage startups, as well as on the VC side. So on the investing side for B2B software. And most recently was a VP of marketing at Series A, and then decided about a little over 6 months ago to go out on my own and kind of start my own consulting business, where I work with lots of different early stage companies instead of just one.
Love that. We are, I'm a big fan of yours, and kind of, I know you share a lot of what you learn and what you consult on kind of publicly on LinkedIn and elsewhere, and just would encourage everybody to go follow along, because you will be smarter for it. Shannon, we do always ask all of our guests before we dig into the conversation, it is the Content Cocktail Hour, what's the favorite beverage you're enjoying nowadays?
Sure. So I stopped drinking alcohol a month ago, mostly just because it wasn't really serving me anymore. Nothing deeper than that. So I've been very into like adaptogenic mocktails. There's like lots of these like L-thalamine, like different fizzy mocktails that you can drink. So I have some from Chin that I have been liking. And then also I drink Recess Seltzer, which is like a magnesium infused seltzer, which I also really like, or kombucha. So those are kind of the three things that are filling my wine glass these days.
I love it. We just had an episode where somebody had mentioned a phony Negroni, and that's something I want to try to figure out now. It's funny. I was just sitting on the couch last night with my wife. I always struggle to fall asleep. Once I fall asleep, I'm fine. But I've been influenced by one of the like craft beverage makers on, you know, there's a bunch of them on Instagram, but I'm like very close to pulling the trigger, and more of the L-theanine was one of the big ingredients there. I clearly know what I'm talking about.
I will say magnesium powder, like I use the, this makes me sound like I'm usually very critical of the wellness industry. So this is very like unusual of me to say a supplement is like changing my life. But there is like, it's called Magnesium and it's by Moon Juice. And I drink it every night. Postpartum, I started to get restless legs and restless arms. And I swear to God, it makes a huge difference. So, which is like the opposite of what alcohol does, which makes it hard for you to sleep.
Yeah.
It's really nice to have that instead. And I do put it in a wine glass. It makes me feel fancy.
Nice. Very fancy. I love that. That's a little like psychological trick there, putting it in the wine glass. Well, cool. Free wellness advice. Let's get to the marketing advice though, Shannon. As we are recording this episode, it is the last day of the calendar Q3. We'll go live with the episode shortly after that. But you've got a unique perspective in what you've started being founder and a fractional CMO, both for your own business and many other businesses. I'm just kind of curious, like high level, as we head into Q4 and head into the new year, it's annual planning season, it's crunch time for the end of the year. What are some of the like major themes that you're seeing in the work that you're doing?
For sure. So number one, I'm seeing more folks plan for 2025 early than I ever saw planning for 2024. So that feels like good news to me, because people are looking a little farther into the future than they were last year. I think there was a lot of concern going into Q1 of 2024 about what is the market going to do? Are we going to go into a recession? Like no one has gotten funding, that kind of stuff. It does feel like we're starting to see more funding announcements right now, which is great. Even more interesting, we're starting to see more funding with less announcements, which I think is really interesting too. So we could get into that maybe if we want to. But I do think there is kind of an influx of energy in B2B tech, which I think is great. I do think we're still going to see a good number of what I've been calling mergers. So not necessarily a lot of folks have been talking about like acquisition, but it's feeling to me more and more like you're starting to see companies come together where they used to co-sell. Now they might just be one company, which I think you are seeing, which, you know, makes sense as you start to see some of the funding dry up, as you see some folks that are really solving such similar pain points. And if we're thinking about a buyer's experience, buyers really don't want to buy 25 different pieces of software anymore. And their budgets, every single thing is going through the CFO, if it's even $10 or $25 or $25,000, right? So the buying process is getting longer. So I think there, if we're looking at like a macro perspective of the industry, I do think you're going to start seeing more mergers as well as some funding announcements, which is great news. So I think that more likely to get funding if you're playing well with others.
Yeah. Early this year, I think I mentioned I called it like an aqua merger to our team. Like we're seeing some of that in the marketplace, consolidation, aqua hires, whatever you want to call it. But I think the two that have happened recently, Uber Flip and Path Factory, Reveal and Crossbeam, like, you know, buyers used to have to spend a lot of time maybe deciding between those two and in a process that wasn't efficient for the buyer or the seller, because, you know, one of them, it was obviously a zero sum game. One of them was going to win, one of them is going to lose. And now all of a sudden that process for both buyer and seller has been consolidated, which is a larger theme in the market as well. I'm curious though, you mentioned the less announcements. Do you think that's just because the rounds are different than they were a couple of years ago, or just people kind of not wanting to puff their chests out a little bit more? What do you think is actually causing that?
So my hypothesis is that there's two things happening here. One of which being just getting funding is no longer an announcement. So I think you actually might think it would be right now, but I think it's feeling like they want to have it align with either a big product announcement or a big set of hires, right? So either an announcement of a big, great leadership team or big product announcement. So I know of a company, a rev tech company that just raised a big round, really good lead investor too. I was like really impressed. And they aren't announcing until they have a new suite of products that they're going to announce. So I think folks know that right now they need to use the momentum of the announcement to drive revenue, not just eyeballs, right? So they want to have a great offer, which as a content person just makes me so happy, right? That they're thinking about the offer that they have on the other end of that announcement. So I think it's that. I'm sure there's something going on behind the scenes with LPs too.
Yeah.
About like announcements and their comfortability about announcing when there's still a little bit of instability in the market, particularly before the election is over. I think we're going to start to see some change once the election is over. Either way, there will be a little less holding of breath, right? Because there won't be change for 4 years, no matter which direction it goes.
Yeah, agreed there. I think that's a really good perspective. Maybe a little bit of a self-serving question here for yours truly, but in addition to that planning, are you seeing budgets being eased a little bit where it felt like they were being rolled back and very tight in previous years? You mentioned 2024, people like weren't even planning very much. What are you seeing? What is that planning process done to budgets for the following year?
So I've heard a few times, this is an N of few, so I'm not sure if this is an actual build, but of saying, I want to spend money, I just need to know how, and I need a real business case. So there definitely isn't this like, hey, we just, like, I have vivid memories of in like 2017, I just had a budget to spend for brands.
Use it,
like,
or lose it.
It didn't matter what it was for, yep. And you got to spend it, and it didn't matter how or why, and, you know, and I worked at a $200 million company. It's not like the procurement process should be annoying there, right? Like you would think it would be bad, but it was fine, right? And I'm not seeing that again, but I am seeing a little bit of like, okay, so we know we have to put our foot on the gas here. Like we know we're going to lose if we don't, right? And some folks are starting to see traction again, which is great. I'm hearing a lot of folks saying they're growing, just not as fast. So it sounds a little like 2016 to me. Like it's saying like, I'm starting to see some growth, but it's just not happening quickly enough. So we need to know where to dump money to know where the growth levers are. So I'm also starting to see creativity coming back, which is something we haven't seen in the last 3 or so years. And like a good example, when I saw you at Inbound a few weeks ago, super creative, like all of those things could not be tied to ROI. There's no freaking way that you were able to attribute every single one of those activations, but people were still doing them because they are back to doing things that are trying to differentiate them in the market, right? So I think a little bit of both. I do think that budgets are definitely still tight. Like there's not an influx of cash, but I'm starting to see them open up a little bit more for experimentation than they used to be.
Yeah, we've heard experimentation as well. Like people have there's small budgets available for experimentation, though that experiment still needs to be tied to a business case or what, you know, very specifically to success metrics. So we've started to see that as well. And I agree, like, it feels like we're coming out of survival mode for a lot of brands, and brands are like, okay, we've survived this crazy 2-3 year kind of rut, whatever it may be in the market. Now it's like, I think you're right. Get through the election, and regardless of which side, that at least provides some stability, and we'll be off and running is the hope. I don't think it's ever going to get back to what it was in 2021, but I think we'll see some loose.
I think that's okay.
Yeah. Okay, let's get a little bit more tactical now. I really appreciate that perspective, kind of broadly speaking. But you mentioned you help founder storytelling. And I'm curious, you know, that like founder brand, founder storytelling, even like influencer creator brand storytelling has become very popular within companies. And I think buyers, people want to buy from people as opposed to brands. I think everybody's in agreement there. But is that a balance with corporate brand, or how do you actually balance the two of founder storytelling? Does that just become the corporate brand, or is it a balance between the two? And how do you guide somebody through that process?
Yeah, excellent question. So I do think they are separate, right? So I think your corporate brand is, your company should still have its own look and feel. It should have its own mission and vision. It should have all of these things, right? The way that I think about your founder's brand is it's like the initial spark that built the corporate brand, right? They are the first thoughts, like the way that it was created. And then they are the one that obviously shepherds it through, which is why I really love working with founders and not just execs, right? People always ask me, they're like, well, can you do this for the whole leadership team? And it's like, I totally can. And I think that we should at some point. But if your founder can't do this, like, we have a bigger issue, right? And I think that my potential hot take, I'm not sure if this is even a hot take anymore, but it was when I first started talking about it, is that I don't mean, when I say founder brand, I don't mean a LinkedIn program. And I don't mean a super charismatic founder that's really loud and like going to be out there and is like speaking on stages. That's not necessarily what I mean. What I mean is taking the essence of why your founder is so obsessed with solving a certain problem for a certain group of people and taking that, building that into a platform, and then distributing that on the channels in which those prospects and customers live. So to be really tactical, an example, say you start a developer tools company, right? Like, I don't know, ngRok doesn't do this, but like if they did do this, right? Maybe they do. And their founder is, there's like three specific things that this founder cares about. There's a reason why they created this product, this company, all these things. And they distribute it on LinkedIn. That would be the worst possible idea like you would ever have, right? You're on Discord, I'm sorry. Like, that is where you're gonna have to be, right? And so thinking about your founder's brand just as strategically as you would think about your corporate brand, right? So if you were to build a corporate brand program and say, well, I'm just gonna use the channel that's the easiest, and it's like, well, I don't really know how, budget would not get approved for that, right? And that makes sense, right? Because you need to be strategic about the way that you're thinking about how you're building saturation in channels where your audience is, and then how that will eventually turn into conversion, right? That's how I think about it. I do think they're fundamentally separate, but they should be really tied to one another.
And there was a subtlety there at the very start. And I think it's probably because you work with founders explicitly. I think a lot of times we think like it's corporate brand first, and then the founder brand fits in that. But it sounds like maybe what you're recommending is founder brand, and then corporate brand sits kind of within that founder brand, which is a very subtle but very important nuance to how to build those.
Well, I guess it depends on how the company was created, right? I think I've said this to you before. My favorite founders to work with are the ones that just got really hyper-focused on solving a problem for a specific group of people. This is often why I end up in vertical software, because they are like obsessed with a certain community of people they're trying to solve a problem for. Obviously, I've worked in MarTech and RevTech too, but it's less fascination about the technology and more fascination about the problem solving, which I think is a super engaging story, right? That is amazing and wonderful to tell, right? And I think especially early stage, you are in a founder-led sales kind of environment. So typically this is already happening. No one has just bottled it up yet and created a way for folks to distribute it in an effective way, right? And I think we did get some of these programs probably 2 or 3 years ago, especially after Dave Gearhart came out with his book about like hire just like a young like intern to like interview you and make 1,000 LinkedIn posts. I don't know if it worked for anyone. I hadn't seen it work, but I think making sure the founder shouldn't feel like work to them. It should just feel like the way that they're running their business, and it's just a part of it, right? And a lot of it they're already doing.
And you mentioned distribution and you mentioned channel. And I think you're so right that, like, I love that example of an engineer founder, probably, you know, who cares? Like, his audience isn't on LinkedIn, right? They're on LinkedIn, but they're not actively using it. I think that's really subtle and important. So I'm sitting here kind of thinking to myself about my own brand. And this podcast has become a really interesting channel for me because I really like these where I get to lob out questions and, like, get perspective both broadly on the market and very tactically about what we're doing. And now it's become kind of the pillar to our content strategy. So I love that advice of it's founder, then corporate, and then also think about it just as strategically as you do your content marketing program. What channels, what's the distribution strategy is just as important, if not more important than the content itself. Because that's how we talk about content, is like distribution is just as important as creation. Yeah, that's fascinating.
And if you think about it, it should also align to the business strategy. So if you are a really high ACV product, so you're at 18-month sales cycle, like million-dollar deals, then maybe one of your channels is small, intimate groups, right? Where your founder is making one-to-one relationships, right? And a lot of people would call that ABM. But I think there is really what you're doing is activating your founder in a way that is building that founder's brand as well as distributing it in the most effective channel, which is like you land three of those deals as an early stage company, you're raising another round, right? Like it's huge, right? But if you're a PLG product, totally different, right? Maybe you do start a podcast. Maybe you do go on a speaking circuit. You do whatever, it depending on who the founder is, right?
That is so good. I'm thinking, my wheels are spinning now about some things we have upcoming at The Juice. So really good stuff. Let's go one layer deeper on that. And then I promise I'll dig us out of this hole as well. But how does kind of corporate content marketing strategy versus founder strategy, founder content strategy, again, kind of one in the same, different, or just what does kind of founder story mean to content marketing efforts?
That's a great question. It depends on the business, right? If your founder is an SME in your industry, that's one thing. I think their voice should be super loud in your content marketing. If your founder is more of a tech innovator coming into your industry to help solve problems, I do believe you should be focused more on your SMEs for content marketing and have your founder really kind of like rise those voices, right? So maybe your founder is more like a facilitator of those people, because I think also like audiences sniff that out so fast, right? Like I think that's really clear. Like I know I've worked in industry selling to, I have a client right now that sells into construction, and their founder historically was in construction. So like totally, we should absolutely be putting that person at the forefront. Whereas I have another company that it works in healthcare, but the founder is actually from tech, but they have like co-founders or healthcare people, right? So I think it really depends. And in terms of content marketing strategy, I do still think as your company gets bigger, you should have a thought leadership platform. Like, what do you stand for? Like, what is the change in the world that you're trying to drive? And that should still be very educational. That should be all. And then your founder can be someone that gives like commentary to that, right? And gives the importance to that. But I still think there's a huge opportunity to build a really robust content marketing strategy that isn't just behind your founder.
Yeah, the previous company I was at prior to The Juice, it was a healthcare analytics platform, very rich, like data-driven content and insights, but nobody on the marketing team, it wasn't even possible for us to be SMEs, right? So, but we were fortunate, one of the co-founders was a SME who had come from the space. So we tried to do that, you know, meet with him weekly, bi-weekly, whatever it was, and just kind of gather what's top of mind for him. I think that's great advice. So you've placed a bet on yourself. You've mentioned you've been at high growth tech companies previously, successful companies, and you've jumped into the fractional CMO world and consulting world. Just tell us a little bit about the bet you placed on yourself, and maybe if there are others considering betting on themselves in this way, what advice would you have for them?
Yeah, some people would say it's like the hot topic of now, and some people don't know what it is at all. So it depends on who you talk to, which is like the classic tech example of like everyone's doing this and then most of the world doesn't know anything about it, right? So I started to have these thoughts. So number one, I said I would never start my own company ever. And the universe loves to like absolutely punk me every time I say I'm not going to do something. It's like, hey, here you go. And I actually know a few of us that have said this. I think I have a mentor that was previously my boss at OpenView. Her name is Margaret Kelsey. I think you know her too. And she said the same thing before she did it. So when I got into VC, I actually think the thing that was most exciting to me about that role was the advising part. And I loved it, right? Like I loved meeting with heads of marketing of early stage companies, helping them problem solve. The thing I've always loved the most is coaching high-performing teams, right? I always joked that like maybe I didn't need to be in marketing. I could be in any kind of function. I just really like managing and coaching people. And so I found a lot of value in that. Also, the way that my brain works is I'm a very like systems thinker, right? Like I see patterns, I'm able to kind of look at those patterns, make connections. I'm actually not particularly good at going deep on many things. It's just the nature of the way that my brain works. Like I always joked, now I can joke, I'm like not detail oriented. Like that is like, I just am not. I see big pictures, I see patterns, I see trends, like that's typically. And so it makes me a relatively good consultant and coach, right? Like I'm able to take what I learned from one client and apply it to others with also understanding nuance, right? So I decided after being in VC that I wanted to go early stage. And I was like, well, maybe I'll be a VP of marketing for like 5 years and then I can go off and maybe start my own thing when, you know, potentially I have a few kids in school, right? So I did get pregnant while I was at my Series A job and had a baby. And while I was out on maternity leave, a ton of change happened in the organization, meaning like the whole team I had built was dismantled. There was just like a lot that had happened. So I came back to a very different job than the one I left. Still really loved the founder, still like really had a good experience there. They were super supportive of me. But a part of me was like, is this the time? Like this kind of feels like potentially the time. My network was really strong at this time, which I think is the number one thing that matters when you're going off on your own, because really you're selling your reputation pretty much at the beginning. So it just felt like the right time for me to do it. I had, you know, a 5-month-old at home that I really didn't want to work till 7 p.m. every night and travel to San Francisco once a month. Like it just didn't feel right, especially when the role had changed so much with me gone. So yeah, I went off on my own. So I work with all early stage B2B tech companies. And I think my biggest thing, if anyone's looking to do this, is number one, the thing that's the hardest is like the mental fortitude of it, right? Like you're going to have a huge influx when you first announce that you're going out on your own. Everyone wants to talk to you. Everyone wants to chat. And everyone I've talked to, their close rate's like 2%, right? At the beginning, because you're trying to find your own product market fit. Like there still really isn't a line item budget for a lot of what we do in tech companies, right? And I think the second thing is you are in sales now, whether you like it or not. So if that's not something you want to do, then like I would think really critically about if this is the right path for you. But I will say I have no regrets, right? Like parts have been really hard. Like I also think there's some seasonality to this job that I haven't quite figured out yet. I think July might be a month I take off. I haven't quite figured it out. Just a lot. I was like, I feel like I kind of worked a lot and didn't make any money, which is the thing that happens when you work for yourself. But then like other months I worked very little and made, you know, my whole full-time salary in half the time, right? So it definitely takes some hustle, but it's really valuable work if you want to build something bigger for later and you have a ton of control over your time, which I think is the biggest plus if you, for me, have a family, which was like the final driving force over the finish line for me.
Yeah, it's awesome. It also sounds like there's a high degree of self-awareness that you benefit from, knowing what you're good at, knowing what you're not good at, knowing what you want and what you value. It just sounds like you kind of had all those, you knew all of those, and that's what allowed you to kind of jump into this. And I think you're exactly right on the mental fortitude, and you're in sales. Like that is, I feel like even on the founder side, I'm like a glorified SDR, I feel like. I'm okay with that. So yeah, that's great advice. I appreciate that.
Your product market fit is hard, right? That is the thing. I do this for companies every day. I do product marketing, I do positioning, I do messaging for companies every day. And I still find sometimes that when I go into a deal, I didn't used to think about it that way. I thought about it as like a relationship. I'm talking to someone I've worked with before. I'm talking to a referral. It's like, this is still a deal that requires you to go up against other budget. And, you know, people still don't really understand fractional CMOs sometimes. Also, people like to hate on that term. It just means you're going to run marketing in a part-time basis, which is really, that's it. We just shorten the title. Like people get all up in their pants about like, you've never been a CMO before. Don't call yourself a CMO. It's like, well, no one has ever been one before they're one. You know, like that's how this stuff works, right? And so I was a VP of marketing. It was a long title. We just shortened it. People need to know that you're going to strategically run marketing and make sure that the doers and the organization know exactly what they're doing. You're going to communicate with the founder. You're going to communicate with the board. And early stage, that's typically the only leadership you need, right? So that's really the problem that we're solving here. Of course, people say it's saturated. So is every other role. And there's good and bad of everything, right? So I think it's just finding someone that's solving the problems that you need solved and someone that you trust, right? Like that's a lot of my jobs are all, every single one is a referral because they want to know it's someone they can trust, yeah. Right? And that's really it.
That's cool. I feel like we're boiling up to our last question here, appropriately so, with the energy and passion in that response. What is one unpopular opinion you have as it pertains to B2B marketing?
A fractional CMO can be incredibly effective and can get you where you want to go far faster than going through an entire hiring process and losing money on, this is probably the hot take, the VP you might fire in 9 months anyway. I've watched a lot of that happen, of leadership teams turn and turn and turn, series A and B specifically, and the amount of money that costs is like so great, right? And if you can get someone with a strategic mind that understands your industry, that understands your business model, to be there 15 hours a week, making sure your doers, you need great doers, are like actually executing on the right work, like that is the secret sauce to growth early stage, instead of having someone sitting in, you know, maybe executive meetings for 10 hours a week, 15 hours a week. I think I've watched it be really impactful. So I think that's potentially unpopular, but I don't really know. It depends on who you're talking to.
I think it's great advice. I think, you know, they say the CMO is the shortest average tenure of any of the C-suite positions. I'm sure we've both seen it where, you know, you hire a VP of marketing or a CMO and they've got two or three people they want to hire and they bring them in and it doesn't go well. And then all of a sudden you've got multiple headcounts that are a challenge or on, you know, that aren't working the way you wanted to. Nothing personal, but it's just not a good fit for the organization. Even if you hire a fractional CMO, even if it doesn't go well, it's so much easier to experiment with and pull out than it is, you know, the organization that often comes with CMO. So I think you're right. It's a great way, especially early stage companies, to move faster and learn faster and likely be successful faster. So I think that's a great unpopular opinion to have.
Glad you agree. And also, I only want to work with you if I'm providing value. Some consultants lock people into 12-month contracts or 6-month contracts. I actually don't do that. If every single month we're still providing each other value, let's keep moving. So I kind of operate like an at-will employee. Like, obviously, I want you to pay me for the months that I'm working. But I also know early stage companies change and grow and shift. And at one point, my skill set is the right one for you. And if it turns into someone else, I will find that person for you, right? I want to get off your balance sheet. That's the whole point, right? And so I don't want to be a fixed cost, right? Like, I want you to be able to grow. And I want, of course, I'd love to become an advisor maybe and like make sure you're still doing the right things and feel supported by me. Like, you're not going to have to ramp me forever. Like, let's just make sure I'm providing value. You're providing value to me. You could be a great referral for me. This industry is small.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to mess with anyone's success here.
Yeah, so that's so cool. And again, because you've been in the seat, you know what that looks like and how that feels. And I think that's so good. So Shannon, if people do want to learn more from you or about the services you can provide, what's the best way for them to do that?
I am very active on LinkedIn. So as I just said, founder brands are not on LinkedIn unless you're me or you, because we sell to that audience, right? RICP is right there. So yeah, feel free to follow me on LinkedIn, Shannon Sweeney Curran. Sweeney's my maiden name. And I also have a website for SSC Consulting, but almost everything is on LinkedIn. So you can see everything there. And then yeah, some cool stuff coming up in terms of the content creation part. And so hope everyone stays tuned to see the cool stuff coming.
Love that. Well, everybody go connect with Shannon on LinkedIn. Shannon, thank you so much for joining us today. To all of our watchers and listeners, thank you for joining another episode of the Content Cocktail Hour. Until next time, same place. Cheers. Thank you for joining the Content Cocktail Hour powered by The Juice. If you want to see more episodes or more resources curated for your role, join us on app.thejuicehq.com. See you next time, same place. Cheers.